and brightest day, in blackest night, all other podcasts tremble in fright. Losers cower before the power. Orange is lust, and blues you can trust. Indigos feel, and white ones heal. Yellow scare, and green ones dare. That sapphire love and black hands glove will rock your foundation without hesitation. Chad and Mars face evil's might. Respect their power, for they'll make you see the light.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chad Bokelman.
I'm Mark Marble.
And this is the Lantern Cast.
Episode 631.
That's right. Back to regular issue reviews with Green Lantern Corps number 12, right?
Yeah, so at least it's not absolute.
Not for a while, at least. So this issue is called Seek and Destroy with writer Morgan Hampton, artist Fernando Pissarin, Will Conrad, Auclair Albert, and Jason Paz. Colorists are Arif Pronto and Ian Herring, letterer Dave Sharp. We have cover artists Fernando Pissarin, Auclair Albert, and Matt Herms. Bunch of variant cover artists, as always. Assistant editor Jillian Grant, editor Kathleen Wisniewski, and group editor Paul Kaminsky. We open up with Enquire, I think that was his name, right? It's because also the name of his people and also the name of his planet. Gone back to, I don't know if he's gone back to his old planet or just found a planet that is dirty, just a bunch of dirty water. But regardless, so the point is for him to go into the planet's core, expel all the microbes and nutrients that he's gathered from all the organic beings, and reanimate Enquire in his image. As he does this, Fatality can feel kind of his mind disappear from her mind. She describes it as a cloud lifting a little bit, but he soon re-enters, the entire planet is now water, and all these water beings shoot up, and he specifically says, every single ounce of water is at my command. She says, this isn't reviving your planet, it's controlling it. And he says, control, a necessary trait I've learned from your organics. Spreading myself through the water more evenly would give my duplicates too much autonomy. There's no time for that. For this to work, I need to coordinate my pawns from a safe place. Now get ready. And he immediately starts moving the entire planet at hyperspeed somehow towards Oa. Meanwhile, on Oa, the Indigo tribe is deep in contemplation and meditation because they're trying to find the reanimation of their own emotional entity, which we learn later on in the book is something that every core is trying to do, obviously not meditate, but trying various ways to find their entities.
The Indigo is just unfortunately more like Aaron Rodgers in the off season, seeking a cave, just a dark place so to contemplate life.
This is a sort of opportunity for them to, them being Kilowog Guy and their trainees, to be learning their final lesson, and the lesson is construct crutches, which is basically there's not always time to think, there's not always time to imagine and generate something new. What's your go-to? And then, you know, a guy's got his baseball bat and so on and so forth. So they're, you know, trying to figure out their crutches while simultaneously protecting the entrance to the Indigo tribe's shelter into the cave so that no one disturbs them while they're meditating. This is when Jessica gives an all points bulletin to the entire planet saying that, hey, we've got to work together. Yet another pep talk. They are over on that island where Larfleeze is at, the island of Sandron, and all the core leaders, which is Saint Walker, Sinestro, Artrocitus, then we have Jessica and John, and Natromo from the Indigo tribe, are coming to talk with Larfleeze about everything that's going on. But while we are trekking to Larfleeze, Jessica lets something slip that apparently we've all known, but we're just now learning. She says, "We haven't been able to pinpoint it yet, but something happened when we all united against the Sun Eaters. A shift of sorts. I think deep down it's why you all chose to stay here." Sinestro acknowledges this, says, "She's right, I felt it." Atrocitus asks why it matters, and she says, "We believe if we can align the whole emotional spectrum, all of us with rings will be able to shift between power sets at will." Larfleeze then decides to make his appearance, says, "That's never going to happen. Oa's going to be real mine." He's like, what's up with his battery? He's got his battery in his hand, and he's like, "You're not stupid enough to believe that's my real battery, the one that's in the main Malachite city." And he immediately detonates, and his entire island goes up in what looks like a nuclear explosion, as seen from space as well. And the entire planet is sort of bathed in this, or at least the immediate affected blast radius is infected with Larfleeze's orange greed energy. As he, whether it's a giant version of him somehow, or just a giant construct of him, I assume the latter, starts tearing the shit out of Malachite City. And it's at this point that wave of energy hits the Thanagarians, who get pissed off and start flying towards the group that are defending the Indigo tribe. So they have to, surprise, surprise, lean on their crutches. Aya creates a ship, the Interceptor. Kelly creates a construct, Wonder Woman, and the rest have, you know, battle axes or gauntlets or whatever. Interesting artistic note, for some reason, the cat dude now looks like a literal cat, except when he transforms into his monster form, and then he just looks like the lion. Well, the cowardly lion, to be precise, but yeah, because he's standing on two legs, but whatever. It's at this point we learn that the group that we thought were dead because of Larfleeze's explosion are not, because Natromo teleported them out of there to where the Indigo tribe are doing their meditation. They decide to go take on the threat. John says he's got to stop by just real quick to check on Cat Matui. And Aya stays behind with Natromo and the Indigo tribe to stay protecting them. The rest of the group arrives on scene to help Sojourner and all the rest of the Corps and Simon Baz against Larfleeze. John goes to check on Katma. Katma says, you know, all you've done is leave me alone while you get what you want. What do I want? You thought when you found me, you could pick up where you left off with your Katma, that everything would be the same. Maybe it was for you, but I'm not her. And then he puts her in a cryostasis chamber that he creates out of thin air just to deal, you know, set her aside, keep her safe. Everybody is taking on Larfleeze one at a time, and Sinestro says, "Well, why don't we try some of this teamwork that you've been telling us all about? So let's hit them all at once and start now." But it's at this point we cut away from that action to go back to the cave. Natromo, and the rest of the course, the Indigo tribe starts speaking in their own language, the Glorin Sun, all that, you know, whatever. Natromo translates and says that there's a large celestial mass heading this way, and Aya says she'll go check. She sends out her energy duplicate, and then she sees the planet that Enquire is sending straight for Oa, and it says next month war for Oa.
Yep, thanks for coming.
What the hell happened in this book? It seemed like we were just getting a bunch of slow setup and building, and all of a sudden it's like Larfleeze bomb planet on the way here. Yeah, what the hell happened?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff here that seems to be dumped all at once. Even the Thanagarians, as far as I'm concerned, are kind of dumped here. There's some. Speaking of dump, there's some interesting info dumping here from the perspective that, you know, officially, you know, in the actual book, not in a map or anything, telling us, you know, the names of all these places that all the different lanterns are kind of their territories. The fact that the Tromo, who we haven't seen in friggin' forever, maybe he was contributing to building those batteries. That was interesting. Hey, we get to see it's a friggin' same Walker sighting, and it's a Red Lantern sighting that's not damn Razor, so I guess that's something too. But Larfleeze, even though he's drawn pretty horribly, Larfleeze being a threat again, having his own, his classic battery back, that's a plus. Mm-hmm. That we haven't seen that Lord Flees is another character that's been treated like garbage over the last few, even just during the whole Jeremy run. It's like he's been minimized and you do nothing with him. And then you have moments like this and it's almost like, well, look, everything's better. So, but I think generally speaking, seeing Lord Flees be a, even I don't know how they're going to resolve this. If Lord Flees is going to end up staying on Oa, I'm not sure how based on the story, the Cat Matui stuff was kind of cool because even though clearly it's being implied that she's being influenced by the orange energy, the point that she's making is still valid. So you know that it may be magnifying her feelings, you know, by 1,000 or maybe 100, but they still are her feelings. So you know there's issues here, which will be curious to see where that's going to go. Whether that just means that he's going to basically return Cat Matui to where she is and he's going to stay, or maybe that's going to be his come to Jesus moment when he's going to realize, well, everything she's saying is essentially correct, that I'm basically looking for my Cat Matui in you and you're not my Cat Matui. So it's not fair to you and it's really not fair to me. So goodbye, and take her back to where she belongs. And then he's being where he belongs with the Green Lantern Corps. But him just locking her up like that, I mean, I guess it is mostly to protect her, but it's a quick way to just get out of the conversation and dealing with real issues. The stuff with Anquar, the planet, I mean, now, in a way that seems so anticlimactic just because it kind of like broke up the momentum of this issue. But the one thing I guess you have to give some credit for in this issue with Hampton anyways, it seems like the pace is going a little faster than any of the stuff that's going on in Jeremy's book.
For the overall story, yes. But the problem is, and I'm going to make the weirdest freaking analogy here, but it's the one that came to my mind, so bear with me. Have you ever driven an all-electric car before?
No, I've only driven a hybrid.
Okay. When I was working at a dealership years ago, and we would take things in on trade, obviously, as you do at a dealership, I got a chance to drive a Tesla for the first time. This series, to me, feels like you're on the frontage road in a gas-powered vehicle, or what you think is a gas-powered vehicle, and you need to get up on the interstate, so you take the on-ramp. Everybody knows you need to start accelerating to start keeping pace with the traffic to be able to merge onto the interstate. This feels like, oh, whoops, I forgot, I'm not in a gas-powered vehicle. I'm in an electric vehicle. And what happens when you push the pedal to the metal in an electric vehicle is it doesn't need to rev up. It just fucking goes. It's 0 to 60, almost like you're getting thrown back in your seat on a roller coaster if you don't know what you're doing and don't know that it can do that, because that's what happened to me my first time in a Tesla. I nearly wrecked it because I was like, oh, I gotta get on the interstate, and I revved up and nearly ran into the back of the guy in front of me because I was not expecting it to just launch like that. Issue 12 just launched. There was no consistency in the pacing. There was no rev up. There was no gradual increase. We were just kind of going here and there for issues 9, 10, 12, whatever, or 9, 10, 11. But then 12 hit, and it's all of a sudden like, bam, Inquire is back and he's got control of the planet, which he's rocketing through space, and Larfleet's just detonated a bomb, and it just went fucking crazy out of nowhere. I have no problem that the story is progressing. Thank God it's going faster and we're getting things faster than what Jeremy has been trying to do. So it's different, but the pacing may have gone higher, but it's been very inconsistent, because all of a sudden we're now going 60 and we were going about 15 in the previous issue.
I think that's valid. The only thing I would say is we have to factor in that Morgan really hasn't been writing this book on his own for very long. So maybe now that he's been continuing your car analogy, now that basically the training wheels are driving analogy in some way, the training wheels are, and he's like all gas, no brakes. That now maybe he either feels that he has to pick up the pace because he's able to pick up on maybe something Jeremy's not or DC's not, that the main book is just meandering horribly, or that this is more maybe his own style, that given left to his own devices, that this is how he would tell a story. That let's see where it goes from here. Let's see if this becomes a status quo. I will agree if it turns out to be a roller coaster where we dip and we flow and it comes back and forth, that like we have a couple of issues where it's really, really, really high paced, frenetic like this. And then we drop off and have two issues where it's like you could take a nap. You're reading the book and you take a nap and somebody flips the pages four pages ahead and it's like, well, just from where you pick up, it's like, I really don't need to go back because I know nothing happened in between. We'll see. I'm almost willing to give him more of the benefit of the doubt on this one because he's only been doing these for a couple of issues on his own now. But was the first issue that he did, was it 9 or was it 10?
10, I think.
Yeah, so I am a little more optimistic just because now, whether you're about the content, there's some things in here that don't make a lot of sense. I don't like the setup. I don't like the idea of again, part of the issue story-wise, or part of the issue to me is story-wise, is that these things that are important, they come out of left field. This is the first hint that we got about, oh, the power shifting, which is not, and let's be honest.
Or that they felt something when everything happened.
Yeah. As much as we've never actually seen under normal circumstances to see Green Lanterns do that. First of all, we know about the power pyramids from Relics Universe. We saw what the Shadow Lanterns were able to do. So the idea of being able to shift from one part of the spectrum to another is not exactly a brand new concept. Yes, we've never seen everybody doing it consciously. Cleanly.
Yeah.
But it's also weird because we were almost led to believe that's because of what was going wrong with the spectrum, why people were able to do that. But now it seems like that's going to be almost retconned that maybe the emotional spectrum is evolving, or maybe even if it's the entire spectrum being treated like being drained together as opposed to working together, that allows some of this crossing. I don't know. I think a lot of plot points came out of the blue. The Cavatui stuff makes perfect sense, but we haven't seen that much fraying of the relationship.
See, that's just what I'm saying is we've had no hint of the Cat Matui thing as in terms of what's been on the page. As far as readers, as far as Green Lantern fans, as far as the fact that we just didn't know anything about John's time in the Dark Sector, this John's time in the Dark Sector and how he found Katma and how he explained things to her and so on and so forth, we could have assumed that this would be a plot point. But in terms of what we've read on the page between John and Katma, there hasn't been any hint of this until, bam, it's out of nowhere. And maybe it's meant to be out of nowhere because of Larfleeze's influence. But, like, that's just it. It's not just her thing that feels out of the blue. All of this happened, ready or not, right now.
Yeah, I agree. And then we had some of those, like the issues with the training and some of these things, and even the kind of the waste of effigy last issue. I agree with that. I think I don't think the way plot points are being introduced, even the stuff with Enquar. It's like this was our first hint that Enquar was even planning on resurrecting his own planet, I believe. Mm-hmm. Let alone, and of course, again, he had to be stereotypical. It's like, he couldn't just be happy resurrecting his own planet. No, he has to kind of resurrect his own planet, but not entirely where they're autonomous and they are all individuals. It's like, no, they're just like one step below. So they basically are just minions or pawns. It's like, as he literally says. So that gets old after a while. I mean, not because the absolute power corrupts absolutely stuff is not worth exploring at times. But it happens. It's the Daenerys hearing the bells moment. It's like these things just happen out of the blue where it's not really set up properly to make it justified why this person has just gone complete, as opposed to just a natural progression. So we still don't know I don't know. This is, and it seems, I got to be honest with you. It seems it's a little too soon to have another attack on Oar storyline. Which you damn well knew was coming, because that was the inherent problem conceptually with putting every power battery of the emotional spectrum on Oa, is that put an even bigger bullseye on Oa than there ever has been before. But I don't think we necessarily needed that right away. But we'll see.
And I think the reason I read Enquar's little speech there to Fatality is because I think they wasted Enquar as a villain in that moment. Because, don't get me wrong, I didn't think they were building a generational, Green Lantern villain here, that we were going to see Enquar for decades to come. But you had a sympathetic villain because if his story is to be believed, he is a victim of the Green Lantern Corps and the Guardians of the Universe just taking control and not doing their due diligence. And what that means to him and his people was they all died except for him. But then you lose me when he does this, because he specifically says that spreading himself would give his duplicates too much autonomy. He's not willing to give up his revenge or do it. He has the ability to restore his people, is what he just said.
Yep, but he's not.
But he's not, because the revenge is more important than fixing the reason he has revenge in the first place. He has the need for revenge in the first place.
Now, they could, again, because it seems like things are getting retconned fast and loose here, that we could find out in the next issue that, that part of his master plan, whether it's true or not, or whether it's what he tells himself to put his squishy head on the pillow every night to sleep better, that once he wipes out Oa, then he will completely return autonomy to his people and then whatever. But it doesn't. But either way, yes, it's like the Venditti, the Dark Stars thing. It's like the fact that, hey, first you just picked the characters that were completely wronged and had every reason to want to go out and kill the people who did not have justice from that perspective done to them and are great threats and everything else. And then we quickly developed into jaywalking detected, lethal force enabled, just because that's the story he wanted to tell, making it a much more, as I've stated before, cookie cutter, more boring version of, instead of delving into the duality of or the question of lethal force, like we talk about with Batman all the time. Is Batman really being noble by not killing, or is he just making himself feel better, but yet allowing a lot more people to suffer because he won't do what's necessary to end a threat once and for all and creates a lot more victims down the road because he just walks away? Instead of delving into a much deeper issue and much more arguably compelling story, it's like, no, we're just going to make it crystal clear almost right off the bat that I think this is wrong and this is why. So it just gets – villains are much more interesting when at least they're fleshed out.
Yeah.
Even in this case when they're water.
Yeah, that's really all I've got. I thought the ending – I thought the ending was bad. It just poorly paced. This is my last comment on it. Just because we spend three pages. So like Sinestro's like, hey, you've been saying we should work together. Let's stop trading blows on Larfleeze, basically, and let's start working together now. And then we cut away from that for three pages to go back to the Indigo tribe so that they can recognize in their own language, so now we got to take the time to translate, that something is on the way to Oa. Then Aya sends her energy duplicate out there only for us to see what we already know, which is a massive splash page of the planet heading towards Oa. Why did we spend three pages to learn something we already knew and made it also our cliffhanger?
Yeah, I agree.
It's a weird way to end this issue. It's a weird cliffhanger to choose, because it's not a cliffhanger. We already knew it.
Well, we didn't 100% know that he was going to Oa. We just assumed he was going to Oa.
Yeah.
But just because it says time to ravage another, I mean, it made perfect sense. But I'm just saying, and I agree with you. From a pacing perspective, it didn't make a lot of sense either, because we're getting into the fight with Larfleeze, which is actually somewhat interesting. And again, arguably, the Indigo tribe is always interesting, even though we barely have seen any of them over the last, like, umpteen years. But then even that momentum gets – those two things kind of – you go from – yeah, you're like, slogging uphill now both ways, because first you go from the action to the meditation, and then it's like, okay, now you're sending Aya out there. And I mean, I guess it's good that it's not friggin' Kelly or Simon's doing other stuff. But I don't know. Let's see what the next issue is like. And I would enjoy it if the pacing, now that they kind of like, you know, let the genie out of the bottle, if the pacing continues to be good, but not like we both mentioned the idea that stop bringing these major plot points out of the blue and just, which is, to be fair, you know, I don't know if I, you certainly can't throw that at Morgan's doorstep because Jeremy's been doing a lot of that.
Yeah.
The fact that, oh, Parallax is dead, but not telling us any reason why anybody would believe Parallax is dead, especially the audience, which knows that he's not dead. That other, or the entities were decimated, though we literally don't only see one, like we see one get hurt and the other one just fade away, but all the other entities are still functional last time we saw them. Things like it's sloppy at times, but let's see. Yeah. Let's give Morgan some, you know, he's spreading his wings, so let's see where this goes. So I'm willing to be a little patient here. I tend not to jump off immediately, even though,
well, Lord knows. I enjoyed the issue for what it was. I'm just saying it's such a departure from what came before it. It's two different problems with pacing. For Jeremy, it's taking far too long to get to the end of any given story arc, and even then it never really ends. It just morphs into another thing. But here with Morgan Hampton, the pacing feels frantic as opposed to intentional and gradual.
Agreed.
So pacing issues all around, but enjoyable issue. So that's
yeah,
all I got.
Yeah, overall, I would say it's enjoyable. Certainly, flaws and all, it's certainly probably more enjoyable than many of the issues we've been getting lately.
For sure. All right, what's next?
Let's put the fork in the Avengers trailers for now, since it seems like we will have a break. So, what did you think of the final two?
The final two? I saw, like, stills, I think, of the Wakanda Fast Fantastic Four one.
But go find it.
No, it's fine. I really don't have much of an interest in it, to be honest with you.
I don't either, and I saw it, so it's all right.
But is the other one the Cyclops one?
Yes, so the other one was the X-Men one.
Yeah. So, yeah, I saw that one. And I saw that one, you know, in high def on YouTube or something off of Marvel's channel. So.
Yeah, that was last week. That was last week's release.
Yeah, that was cool. I like to just seeing, because it's an iconic comic image, Scott ripping off his visor and, you know, just going full haymaker with his vision blast or whatever. So plus, you know, seeing the Sentinel in the background and everything, or what we assume, I guess, is a Sentinel in the background was cool. As far as the conversation between Magneto and Xavier, I don't know that I got anything out of it. It just seems like more of the same from them too. I mean, I think the important part there was just hearing their voices as played by those actors, not necessarily what they were saying.
Yeah, I'm not a huge Cyclops fan. So compared to other people, I understand the importance of Scott in the comic books. You know.
Oh, I don't like Scott either.
As opposed to the relative unimportance of Scott in the X-Men movies, of no matter whether it's the First Class Scott or whether it's the Marsden Scott, he definitely was done wrong as far as being overshadowed by Wolverine, which is understandable because Wolverine is more popular, and even before Hugh Jackman became what Hugh Jackman became because of Wolverine. Wolverine is inherently, for the, you know, the most popular X-Men character that's been going ever since, you know, they rose to prominence in the 80s. The costume is cool. Seeing the Jim Lee costume, yeah, that's cool. And I have confidence that they're going to give him his due, certainly more than he's gotten before in any of these movies. But the Magneto stuff was more. Talked what he was saying and with Charles was important, but it's only important based until we see what happens in the movie, because, you know, at the end of the day, some people have pointed out while Magneto and Charles might have like 90% in common, and it's the 10% that they don't have in common that always ends up rearing his head. So even if they happen to be on the same side at one point in the movie, it doesn't mean that Magneto is not going to Magneto at some point. So we'll have to see. To me, though, yeah, the Wakanda one means nothing. It was an odd choice from a timing perspective, because that trailer is by far the least impressive of all of them. You can The Steve one gives you the least about the plot on the surface, even though, you know, him having a child might be important. That's just confirmation he was coming back. But so arguably the Wakandan one, because you're having basically reading between the lines, you have all these characters that are tied to Fantastic Four, Namor tied to Fantastic Four, the Black Panther introduced in what Fantastic Four, all these characters coming together for the, and plus to the first time we ever see, at least on film, Fantastic Four interacting with anybody in the main MCU, the 616, but yet they're characters. And I like Shuri. I like M'Baku, and I like, for the most part, I like the Fantastic Four they've given us. But yeah, that trailer means nothing to me. Means nothing. It seems like it was almost guaranteed that trailer was going to land much more with a thud than any of the other three. So why have that one come out last? I don't quite understand. It either should have been first, or probably it should have been third, and you should have like hit it in like kind of like where it was either everything can will get hot, well, people will get more pumped after this one and quickly move away from it, or it's going to get sandwiched around two trailers that people are going to care more, so it won't kind of like be a speed bump. I do like the fact that people have been trying to figure out what some of the timestamps are at the end, besides because you get the regular Doomsday clock, but I guess when you slow it down, there's an individual code for each of the four trailers besides just the normal countdown, you know, counting down to December of 2026. And one of the most obvious theory, or not obvious, but the most likely theory to be valid is that if you look at the timestamps for all of them, they match up with moments in Endgame. And one has to do so I think the Steve trailer comes down, matches up with when the Ancient One is talking to Bruce about what will happen when the Infinity Stones are removed from the universe. And I think the Thor one talks about that. The Thor one has to do with when they're capturing Loki in Avengers Tower. So that also has to do with two Infinity Stones there, because it has the Tesseract and it has the Scepter. And the X-Men one that's the one with Thor talking to Rocket about what the Reality Stone, right, saying that we have to get the stone. And the last one, the Wakanda one, refers to the conversation Rocket is having with Ant-Man about, do you want to go into space, right when they're talking about going to get the last two stones, including the Soul Stone. So a lot of people believe that they're really playing this up, which we talked about a little bit. We talked about Doomsday, I think, last week, that would be a much more viable cause, potentially, of as a catalyst for causing the multiverse to collapse, is that the removal of all these stones, regardless of whether they were, quote unquote, put back at some point, that might be the catalyst for causing all these worlds to fall, to collapse onto each other in a cascading effect, but that's it. I don't think we are getting, as of now, it doesn't seem like we're getting anything again for a while. So,
but yeah, for the Wakanda Fantastic Four trailer, I think I didn't bother watching it because I thought they wasted the opportunity, because there are lots of reasons to see Doomsday. There are lots of reasons or things that'll put asses in seats. And even though it's not a big percentage, I fully admit it, it's still one of them. What was the draw of some of the first, like Iron Man, Thor, Cap movies, is the end credits scene when we saw, you know, Agent Coulson doing his thing. You know, you would see the hint of Thor's hammer at the end of one movie and you're like, oh shit, it's all connected. The part of the draw is seeing the characters interact for the first time. You gave us a pretty decent Fantastic Four movie, and our first interaction with the MCU and getting to see them, you spoil it with a minute or so trailer and waste it on them meeting the Wakandans in a throwaway moment that really kind of means nothing at the end of the day. That's our first interaction of the FF and the MCU we know.
That we see, yeah. Yeah.
Well, but that they chose to give.
No, I'm not challenging you. I'm saying you can almost take it to the bank. That is not going to be the real first interaction in the movie.
Right.
But the point is, yes, that the first, what they choose to show us is kind of, and honestly, other than playing off the humor, at least it would have made more sense if it was Reed meeting Shuri, because at least there would be the commonality of arguably you have the two smartest people in their respective universes coming together. That would make more sense. And I think that's probably part of the scene. Some have also speculated that, depending on how the movie goes, maybe either Reed was removed from that scene, or maybe Dr. Doom was actually supposed to be there behind Ben too, but we don't know it, because there's some rumors about Dr. Doom actually pretending to be the hero. before everybody realizes that he's not there to help, which is would be a really tricky thing to pull off, because we, as an audience, we already know that he's not. Yeah, it's shaky. It would be a shaky premise to do for almost a borderline 3-hour movie that we already know that this guy is not going to. I mean, he may think he's the hero, but we know ultimately, as far as everybody else is going to be concerned, that he's not. But they all think that he is until you have that moment, that big reveal when it's like, no. But either way, I agree. I think the Wakandan trailer, I think that was the weakest of the four. And I thought that was a trailer in quotes, because of course the Russos have come out and said, well, none of them are really trailers. It's like they're stories, they're clues, which is another reason why people had been mining for those, trying to figure out what those codes were, and if they were. And it's a valid theory. I think it may not be true. It may turn out not to be true. But since we know this movie, based on what we've heard, is that it's going to be a direct sequel to Endgame, that having them all have timestamps, arguably to go back to moments in Endgame referring to the Infinity Stones or the pursuit thereof, that would be clever, and that would make sense.
Returning to the point for a second, I think my point was, as a studio, you have one chance to trade in on the specific draw that comes with pairing franchises on the screen for the first time. And regardless of where it happens in story, in movie, for the audience, they chose to squander that first interaction hook on a meaningless trailer snippet a full year in advance, mind you, instead of choosing to present a more meaningful moment, if not waiting till the film itself, or maybe the main theatrical trailer for the movie whenever that drops, and instead chose to trade in on that value with the weakest offering of any of those choices.
Yes, I would agree. And like we just said, you know, the timing of where you're going to slot it, which again makes you wonder if they did rearrange some of these trailers, but we don't know if they did, because there was a rumor, the rumor all along, there was a Doctor Doom trailer, and obviously, or a story, whatever the hell the Russos want to refer to these as, that there certainly was everything was pointing to there was going to be a Doctor Doom one, and clearly there was not a Doctor Doom one. They're waiting for Doctor Doom, waiting for Godot, waiting for Doctor Doom. Yeah, it does seem, and another thing, we kind of joked about this last week too, is like, there's more than a little irony to the fact that this movie is Avengers Doomsday, and we've had four snippets, sneak peeks into the story somehow from a character perspective, and we haven't seen a focus on either of the two teams that are technically Avengers teams, or calling themselves Avengers, or vying to be Avengers teams. That's almost comical at this point, that you didn't see not one Thunderbolt, or not. We know technically, I think Thor is supposed to be part of Sam's team, but still, the point is, he certainly wasn't an active member of any team last we saw. So the reality is, we've had no actual Avenger sightings, which kind of fits perfectly into phases 4 through 6, because they avoided even talking about Avengers for like 6 or 7 years.
Yeah. All right. What else we got?
I'm going to roll through this quick, because it's the quickest left on my list of stuff. I actually have more stuff than usual. What I've seen hasn't been much, and you and I talked about one of these, but I did see Anaconda, the Jack Black, Paul Rudd, pseudo reboot, sequel, requel, whatever. It was okay. I mean, it's not like, you know, super, super funny. But again, any movie with Paul Rudd and Jack Black in it, you know, you have a floor for how unfunny a movie can be, because they're just naturally funny. The movie was enjoyable. Do I ever really need to watch it again? Probably not. But Daniela Melchior, I don't know if I can pronounce her last name right. Ratcatcher 2 from this Gun Suicide Squad movie. She had a major role in this movie. She's always cool to see. So I enjoyed that. And there's a few somewhat surprising or not surprising cameos, depending on one's perspective on things. But I think that's a definite, that just kind of reeks a cable. And speaking of appropriately, I did see Greenland 2, one of Chad's big movies from last year that never actually got released till this year. I don't have the background on seeing the first movie. As I mentioned to Chad, I started watching the first movie on HBO Max. I have yet to finish it, but this movie on its own is going along with here's our Green Lantern tie-ins. It's paced. It's a really odd pace. That it's pretty slow. It's not particularly exciting. And it's also very predictable. It's just like, okay, we're going to take these characters and we're going to move them on the map to point A. And then they're trying to they get to point A and then something predictably bad happens to them. And then we're going to move them to point B and something predictably bad happens to them. And it's just it's no offense to Lemony Snicket, but it's a series of unfortunate events. And it gets old because it kind of things like that just raise my frustration level. Just because when I'm watching a movie, it makes it hard to enjoy because it's like, come on, really? Again and again and again. Kind of like how I got frustrated with Avatar: Way of Water when they were torturing all those whale-like things towards the end of the movie. Until you at least realized theoretically there was a reason why they were doing it, not just to be mean. But we don't know that at first, so they just are literally trying to get a visceral reaction out of you. And that really angered me when I watched that movie. It's like, who would enjoy this? And after a while, that gets to me. So that's it for that. Hasn't been much. There has not been much lately to see. It's going to pick up, but that's that. So using the two quick things about apps. One thing we talked about before, one that's brand new. Now you I think you had mentioned you hadn't been on Disney Plus in a while. Yeah. I hadn't been on Disney Plus in a while either until about probably right after we recorded that episode, because that's when they dropped Tron Ares. So I went back to watch Tron Ares. And when I was watching Tron Ares, and this wasn't just a Tron Ares problem, which I found out not just from research, but on my own, just trying to play another movie. Disney Plus was having this glitch where it wasn't a buffering issue, but the frame would like freeze. Like every 10 or 15 seconds, the frame would freeze. I don't think it affected the audio, but it was affecting the frame. So if you were actually trying to watch the movie, it was kind of problematic and borderline nauseating. Because the image would just keep sticking, and then it would unfreeze and everything else. Now, based on what I read online, this had been going on for several weeks, and Disney Plus was aware of it, and I think they might have fixed it, because I did watch Tron Ares. I tried to pick up where I left off, and I did have my glasses on, so it's not like I just put it on and I did not see it glitching anymore. So they might have fixed it because the word on the street was they were aware of it and they were trying to fix it, but. I'll be curious if anybody else that's had experienced that. And I also read somewhere, which was odd, considering that it seemed to be a video problem more than an audio problem. But people had said if you went into the Fire Stick settings, because you can't – Disney Plus, the app itself has no real audio visual settings. They just have the basic, well, we want to play up to the maximum capacity of your tech, of your equipment, or do you want to go to, down to standard, basically standard HD and things like that. But you have no individual control. You only have that on the Fire Stick. But somebody said if you went and you turned off all the Dolby sound settings, that actually made a difference as a temporary fix. But that could be squared away. But I would be curious if anybody experienced that or is still having that issue. HBO Max. I want to revisit this ever so briefly. I remember talking about this back in August when they did this, when they added in the play suggested movies and TV show feature. It made it a when they either added it in out of the blue or it was always there, but they made it mandatory that it was defaulted as on. And I pointed out that the flaw was when you turned it off, it prevented HBO Max from working the way that it normally used to, which was just like Disney Plus, just like Netflix, where if you were watching something and your movie ended, it would just, the Fire Sticks eventually would just go to its screensaver and everything would shut down in order, depending on your equipment, your sound bar, the Fire Stick, the TV. But when they fixed, when they added in that feature, even if you turned it off on HBO Max, it would stick on the screen for the next recommendation. But it must, just like a vampire charge, it must have been sending a vampire signal to the Fire Stick from the app because it would never time out. So if you forgot to shut your movie off, you just left the TV on and you forgot, or you forgot which app you left it on. You thought you left it on Netflix, but you didn't. If you were gone 5-6 hours, that screen would still be on. So you had to be careful about it freezing. The image onto your screen. So like 2 weeks ago, I just waved the white flag and said, I've been trying to make this work the old way and it just wasn't working. So I turned it on the recommended features. One of the things that I found interesting about it was number one, the real weakness was it always likes to make the same suggestion over and over and over again. So if it's something you don't like and their algorithms are not great, I mentioned how if you're watching Couples Retreat, it tried to play The Hangover, which is not entirely different kind of movie. and they try to play, and for some reason when I watch Ex Machina, which this isn't as bad, but they try to play Constantine all the time. And if not, they must have a Keanu fix for some weird reason. Well, if they played Replicas, it would make sense after Ex Machina, but instead they play like one of the John Wick movies. But for Midsommar, which I watch all the time, especially since it's leaving, that they always recommend The Witch, which I hate. But if you go over and you look at the settings where you can give a thumbs up or thumbs down on reviewing the movie, there's a setting where you can say not interested, and it won't recommend that movie anymore. But the most interesting thing about this, and this is the only reason I'm really mentioning it, is that the algorithm does seem to learn your habits, because there have been plenty of times, and today is a classic example, that sometimes it will just loop the same movie over and over and over again, which I personally wish there was a feature just to do that, but it just does it. Sometimes, so this is like at least the fourth day since I've done this, that it just basically starts the same movie over and over again. Eventually it'll go to something else. But it'll play the same movie like 5 or 6 times unless you interrupt it, which I'm personally okay with. But I just thought that was interesting about that aspect of HBO Max, that at least the algorithm is learning. At least you can get rid of a suggested movie that you don't like, so you don't have to see it over and over again.
I'll find out whenever Lanterns releases.
Yeah, it would be. Like I said, I wouldn't mind it as much. I would have probably kept the algorithm on. I've kept it on the first time back in August if some of the suggestions made sense. Like with Final Destination, which is how I mentioned last year when we talked about it, I found it out the day, I think it was August 1st, when they put in Final Destination Bloodlines, because I woke up. I fell asleep on purpose on that movie because I knew it was – I fell asleep. I woke up. It was 5 in the morning. I put it on, and I knew I wasn't going to stay awake, but I said, oh, I'll just fall asleep to it. Then I woke up like 8:30 or something, and all of a sudden it was playing like Final Destination, the first one. It's like, why is it playing another movie? And that's when I found out that they added that in. If their algorithm was better at suggestions, that wouldn't bother me as much. But I do like the fact that if you just say not interested, then it seemingly doesn't recommend that movie for you again automatically. So there's that. And the last thing, which we kind of again alluded to in the movie episode, but now it's actually official, that the long national nightmare is over and Kathleen Kennedy is gone from being president of Lucasfilm. That she will be gone, and Dave Filoni and Lynwyn Brennan will be the co-presidents. So that will be interesting to watch. Now, Kathleen Kennedy, obviously she was really bad at this job. And she deserves a lot of the blame for things that went wrong at Lucasfilm. I mean, Bob Iger is no saint either, because Bob Iger has skirted through a lot of this stuff. You know, Iger, along with Kathleen Kennedy, obviously was the one who wanted to push out Star Wars, that sequel trilogy, so fast that they didn't have any idea what it's about. He had no coherent vision. But from a creative perspective, Kathleen Kennedy had no clue. I mean, obviously we saw her get rid of creators left and right, but yet she wasn't bright enough to insist that, hey, you know, we need one scene where Han, Luke, and Leia are together again on screen. It's like, not that you should have had to be dragged there kicking and screaming. Anybody with a brain in their head should have realized you have to have that moment, like you were talking about, that payoff moment when characters interact for the first time, or that you haven't before, that you want that moment where characters that haven't been together in forever reunite, that you want to see that, as opposed to, oh, no, we're not going to do it. And so Bob Iger is to blame for a lot of things that have gone wrong with Disney, and along with Lucasfilm. But Kathleen Kennedy's creative choices and her added, and the whole forces female stuff and going out of your way to kind of alienate the original fan base and make it sound like, ah, oh, we don't need you because we're going to go after this group, even though this group doesn't really care about Star Wars, and among other things. And it's just, who knows what the future is going to be for Lucasfilm. It's just that at this point, she definitely needed to go, and there needed to be a new voice. And we'll see. But at least from Bob Iger's perspective, at least he did outlast Kathleen Kennedy. Not by long, not by much, but at least he can put that in his resume. He's like, see, I knew I could do it.
Yeah. Ding dong, the witch is dead.
I know. So I was funny. It's funny you said that, because I was watching. I still have it open. I was watching the video, Grace Randolph's video on this, which at least through the first 20 minutes of her, 25 minutes almost of her 52 minute video, she was kind of even keeled about this in her approach. She wasn't going off the deep end in a lot of things. But that she literally has that as one of her bullet points, that the witch is dead. Because that's the way a lot of people were going to react. And it is funny. And this was an accurate point out from her. But which she, as in Grace Randolph, took offense to. But this is just payback. She pointed out that The fact that the news broke today, because we're recording this on a Thursday, on Thursday the 15th, that the fact that this came out on Thursday was not done by accident, because if you want to bury a story, you dump it on a Friday afternoon. So if you wanted to dump a story and have people forget about it real quick, you dump it on a Friday afternoon. The fact that they dumped this like on a Thursday afternoon opened the door for people to talk about it today and during the day tomorrow and make videos on it. So this was clearly done on purpose. But whoever was the one making the decision, to today's the day we're going to officially announce it, because this story has been out there for a couple of weeks. That's why I alluded to the future of the Dave Filoni verse and relation to Mandalorian and Grogu, the movie coming out, and how there were some stories that his universe was up in the air. And I said, well, up the room, I didn't want to go into specifics until it was proven true. But that was what I was alluding to, that the rumors, the story had been out there already that Filoni was going to be one of the two co-presidents, which obviously greatly increased the odds that his universe in some way, shape, or form continuing for the foreseeable future. But yeah, dumping it on a Thursday was probably not an accident for, and she made a lot of bad decisions. She was over her head in this position, and it is what it is. I mean, did she have some successes? Yes. How actively involved she was in those in that process, it doesn't matter. I mean, she gets technically a couple of checks in her column for things that landed because she's the head. You can't just blame her because she's in charge for all this, everything that goes bad. You have to give her some check marks on those boxes when things go right, even if she's not creatively necessarily all that involved on either side. But even though there's more evidence when she's been creatively involved, they've been mostly bad projects overall. But either way, it's time. We needed something else. Lucasfilm had kind of become a non-factor, and she really should have been pushed out the door if they could. And again, that's those long-standing rumors that contract for president of Lucasfilm is not an easy thing to get out of, which probably there's got to be some truth to it, because I have a hard time believing Iger or Chapek wouldn't have fired her. I don't buy that. Oh, no one would have taken the job. Somebody would have taken the job. Just like if the Jets had fired Aaron Glenn, Chad, somebody would have taken that job. As bad a job as it would be, somebody would take it because it's an opportunity. And there's only a few of those jobs in the world you would take it. There had to be some truth to the fact that getting her out of that contract, firing her, was not that easy. Though, why they ever extended her contract, for the life of me, that's the part I don't understand. If you can't fire her, that's okay. No one put a gun to your head to give her another contract. But that's it. That's all I have to say about that.
Well, let's end on sandwiching some Green Lantern topics, because we don't have a lot to say about this, but it's worth mentioning that the Green Lantern McFarlane page punchers have started hitting places for pre-order, if not appearing in stores, because the page punchers for Hal Jordan from Green Lanterns number 48,
yes,
is out, and the Platinum Chase, being the Jessica variant, is also making waves. I need to see these figures in person to determine specifically if I want Hal. I would like Jessica, but from the sound of things, I probably won't get Jessica. We shall see. Both it'll be in the wild. I'm not going to try and find Jessica online on the aftermarket, especially right now. And just secure one right away, especially because it's a chase and there's really no guarantee you're going to get one other than the third party market.
There's a few in Australia right now. It's the shipping that kills you, which is, I noticed, as you were talking, I brought it up in eBay. There's a few that are only like around $40 from Australia, but unfortunately, when you tack on the shipping, that brings it up to like $60.
Yeah.
But that's still cheaper than anything here. Everything's like between $70 and $100 at least.
Yeah. So it's hard to get your hands on those are supposed to be appearing in Walmart's, Targets, and GameStops. So if you want to try and find the Jessica Chase out there in the wild, that's where you're gonna need to be looking. But I know Mark already pre-ordered with something.
Yeah, I actually got Hal, which was weird, because the one place it seemed that didn't sell out. This was a weird rollout, and I didn't get the notification immediately, so I can't vouch for, like you and I could vouch for, the fiasco entertaining story that it was for the Emerald Twilight, Hal Jordan McFarlane, that of the Green Lantern 49 one, that I was busy, so I almost forgot. I mean, I knew the 14th was the day it came out because I'd gotten in my head, but I didn't make a note of it. And so it slipped my mind. So then by the time I went to check, all these places had sold out. Walmart was sold out. McFarlane was sold out. Amazon was sold out. The one place that still had it available for pre-order, and mine shipped actually, was GameStop. And the fact that these are 7-inch page punchers versus the smaller ones, that made me decide to pull the trigger. Now, related to this, now this is interesting too, because unfortunately, once again, if I had gotten that email earlier or I checked the email earlier, because it may not be proven true, but it probably would have been worth rolling the dice just because between you and I, we would have, and everybody else, you know, obviously we know getting rid of the rest of these figures would have been easy. That there was this, somebody posted that they couldn't confirm it, but that if you had bought a case of the Hal and Barry, that Jessica was in a case.
Hmm.
And I think it was only a case of 6 figures. So, and I guess, is there a Jay Garrick? There's a Jay Garrick one, right? Yeah. Isn't Jay Garrick? So that would actually make sense when you think about it. If it was a case of 6, then you could have 2 Hals and a Jessica and 2 Barrys and a Jay. So that would actually make sense. But by the time I saw that and went to Entertainment Earth, and they were selling a case of these, and it was not crazy, but they were sold out. But if I had seen that earlier, and I had read, I had that little bit of tidbit, even if not getting rid of the 3 Hals and the 3 Barrys, I think between the two of us, that wouldn't have been particularly challenging. But
yeah,
I would like Jessica. Mm-hmm. It sucks that Jessica's not, she's not going to be one where you can pre-order her. This is one of the things I really hope Mattel does better. That I really hope that this goes.
Yeah, speaking of Mattel, I have the Mattel Jessica, the DC Multiverse line that they had a Kyle as well, but one of our listeners, I won't name them, but was kind enough to send me a Jessica. So that's why I can live without Page Puncher Jessica. I would still like her, but you know, I'm not gonna go out of my way because at least I have a Jessica.
Yeah, I don't. And again, I'm not going to go crazy for it. I think it's a nice looking figure. So I would like to get it. And let's see how many of these flood the market. I mean, you never know with these. Some of these have become, they're expensive, but they're not crazy. And then there's unfortunately the one I'm never going to get, the Spectre Hal Jordan variant.
Yeah.
That even looking today, like the cheapest price you're going to find this for on eBay is like $400, $500. It's like, I mean... And I can't. I mean, no matter how you look at it, you can't justify that. It's ridiculous. Even with $100, I couldn't really just. Under the right circumstances, I suppose you could justify $100. I mean, considering I've probably spent like, I think the most I've ever spent on a Funko maybe was like 40, was like 60 maybe. So I guess I could justify a full size action figure if I had to. If it was something because it has value and importance to me, I guess I could justify it. But certainly, I'm not gonna be spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars upon. Yeah, but let's just hope when Mattel, if it's true that, you know, McFarlane's will lose the entire license at some point, that let's hope Mattel does a better job at this, because it's just garbage that they release figures like this where you can't either you have the pre-order or it's gone in 2 seconds, or in this case was, oh, we have something that's an exclusive, so you have to basically stumble into it. Now, the good news is, as you mentioned, this is not just a one-store exclusive. So at least there's a chance you might find it in other stores. I actually checked my Walmart today, which had absolutely nothing. But I'm more likely to find it at Target just because I'm at Target more. But I would like to get it, but it's not the end of the world.
For sure. All right. Well, if people want to reach out to us, what do they do?
LanternCast@gmail.com. The website, obviously, is LanternCast.com. You can follow us on Blue Sky, Twitter, Facebook, #GLcast to track us down. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, wherever you listen to us on. Please leave us a positive review. Last but not least, if you'd like to leave us a text or a voicemail like Corbin, which we'll probably play real soon, 708 Lantern, and let us know what you think.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.